Hello, you are listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. Today's episode is a video and audio recording of a panel from our March 2026 conference in Omaha. The panel title is The Wealth of Nations at 250, and there are four speakers. The first speaker, Eric Mattson of the Catholic University of America, introduces the panel, then presents his paper, Theory, Reality, and Public Policy in the Wealth of Nations. He is followed by Paul Mueller with The Continuing Relevance of the Wealth of Nations to Public Policy 250 Years Later. Then, Jordan Ballor with A Biblical Myth at the Origin of Smith's Wealth of Nations, and John Robinson, Adam Smith and Pope Leo on the Origin and Significance of Private Property. Here's the panel. Enjoy.
So we have three speakers. I'll present first. So actually, we have four speakers, three in addition to myself. So first, we have Paul Mueller. Paul is a senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. He received his PhD in economics from George Mason University. So Paul and John and I are actually all old classmates. Paul's work has appeared in many journals. His popular writing has appeared in USA Today and Fox News, as well as the Intercollegiate Review, Christian History, Adam Smith Works, Religion and Liberty, among others. Paul is what you might call a man of parts. He wears many different hats. So in addition to serving as a senior research fellow at AIER and the associate director of the Religious Liberty in the States Project, he also runs a bed and breakfast in Colorado and is involved in local politics. You can ask him how he manages to do so much, while he also has six children and a wife, Catherine. Our next speaker is Jordan J. Ballor. Jordan serves as the executive director of First Liberty's Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy, which includes administration as well as pursuit of his own scholarship. He has previously held research positions at CRCD, at the Acton Institutes, and a university in Amsterdam that I can't pronounce. He has doctorates in Reformation history from the University of Zurich and moral theology from Calvin Theological Seminary. And last but not least, John Robinson is associate professor of intelligence analysis at James Madison University. He lives with his wife and six children in Harrisonburg. After growing up as a military brat, he discovered his place. He's a parishioner at the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church, and he'll be presenting on Popes Leo and Adam Smith. So let me begin my presentation, Reality, Theory, and Policy in the Wealth of Nations. This is the last regular session of the day, so I'll try to keep things a little bit light here. We have our own Josh Bowman. He told me earlier that he was going to count this as a citation. Power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. So with my apologies to Josh, I will be using a PowerPoint. Just another light item. I don't particularly like artificial intelligence, but I did use it to generate this picture of our friend Adam Smith, who is celebrating the 250th birthday of his great work, The Wealth of Nations. Okay, now for something a bit more serious. So I want to start with a story. So once upon a time, there was a man who read The Wealth of Nations, not a summary, nor a volume of selected passages, but The Wealth of Nations itself. He began with the introduction. He read the most famous first chapter on the division of labor, the chapters on the origin and use of money, the price of commodities, the wages of labor, the profits of stock, the rent of land, and all the other well-known economic portions of the first book, not omitting the long digression on the fluctuation in the value of silver during the last four centuries and the statistical tables at the end. Having completed the first book, he went on to the second, not deterred by the fact that it is supposed to contain an erroneous theory of capital and an untenable distinction between productive and unproductive labor. In book three, he found an account of economic development of Europe since the fall of the Roman Empire, with digressions upon the various phases of medieval life and civilization. In the fourth book, he came upon extended analyses and criticisms of the commercial and colonial policies of European nations and a whole battery of free trade arguments. Finally, he attacked the long concluding book on the revenue of the sovereign. Here, he found even more varied and unexpected matters, an account of the different methods of defense and of administering justice in primitive societies, and of the origin and growth of standing armies in Europe, a history of education in the Middle Ages, and a criticism of 18th century universities, a history of the temporal powers of the church, of the growth of public debts in modern nations, of the mode of electing bishops in the ancient church, reflections as to the disadvantages of the division of labor, and what is the main purpose of the book, an examination of principles of taxation and systems of public revenue. Time is too short to enumerate all that he found before he came to the concluding paragraphs written during the opening events of the American Revolution concerning the duty of colonies to contribute towards the expense of the mother country. Now, of course, I may have exaggerated somewhat. There probably was never such a man. So, The Wealth of Nations is a huge, sprawling book. And sometimes, frankly, it's an incredibly boring book. Why should we still care about The Wealth of Nations? Why should we read The Wealth of Nations? For historical significance, I suppose, you could say, the book is reasonably considered the start of the modern discipline that we call economics. It's had a massive historical impact. Smith, of course, still serves today as a kind of moral icon, certainly a moral authority in our conversations, particularly in America. But beyond historical significance, which is an important point, why should we read this book? To learn economics? Not particularly, in my view. Wealth of Nations absolutely presents vital economic insights, but not always in the most accessible way. There are some parts of the analysis that haven't stood the test of time. A new student to economics, I think, would be better served by reading, say, Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics or Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. So what about to encounter underappreciated doctrines? Maybe, but again, I think probably not. So Smith had many vital insights on spontaneous order, on price theory, the limits to central planning, state capture theory, fiscal policy, free trade, and so on and so forth. But these arguments find, I would argue, more elegant and elaborate expression in the 19th and 20th century followers of Smith, including Friedrich Hayek, James Buchanan, and Milton Friedman. So then why should we read The Wealth of Nations? I think there are many things that you could say. I recently wrote a paper, I proposed one reason. So my answer to this question is that we should read and even study The Wealth of Nations and its historical context, because the work illustrates how a great mind bridged gaps between theory and political practice in his efforts to actualize social improvement. So let me just make a few observations here. The Wealth of Nations is both a treatise and a kind of political tract. It's an analytical work, it's a work of economic theory, but it's also a political tract in a sense. Smith was looking to affect public policy, and he weaves together economic analysis and policy prescriptions in a powerful way. The correspondence, though, between the treatise and the tract elements of the work is inexact. That is, there's no one-to-one mapping from Smith's economic analysis to his policy recommendations. And the inexactness of this correspondence stems from two interrelated gaps that Smith clearly recognized. The first gap is the gap between economic theory and political practice. Donald Winch wrote, and he was correct, he wrote that for Smith, there's no simple one-to-one relationship between economic analysis and what we could call economic policy. So for Smith, good policy cannot be reduced to good economic analysis, and good economic analysis cannot be reduced to political feasibility or pragmatism. Now, this insight about the difference between theory broadly construed and practice was actually a mainstay of methodology in classical economics. It fell away for different kinds of reasons in the sort of economics that came to be known as mainstream in the 20th century. The second, and in my view, more interesting gap in Smith is the gap that he perceives between theory and reality itself, that is, between the thing that we try to explain and the tools that we use to explain. Smith was, in my view, much less sanguine about the overall prospects of the theoretical or scientific enterprise than many of his later followers, including many political economists. Unlike many of his contemporaries, he did not have faith that progress in science, progress in economics, would or even could sufficiently inform social and political reform. For Smith, in both natural philosophy and moral philosophy, reality spills over the buckets of theory that we try to contain it in. I'm not sure how helpful this picture is. Maybe it's useful, but the point here is just to say that Smith perceived these various gaps between theory and reality and between theory and policy. You can discern these gaps as you try to weave together the tract and treatise elements of The Wealth of Nations. So I'll move quickly over this first gap between theory and practice, since I think it's a bit more straightforward. This, I pulled this image from the internet. This is, I note, not the actual quote, so this is a paraphrase, even though it's being passed off by AZ Quotes as a quote. It's not actually a quote, but it's a decent enough paraphrase. The man of system is apt to be very wise in his own conceit. In the great chessboard of human society, every single piece has a principle of motion of its own, altogether different from that which the legislature might choose to impress upon it. This is not from The Wealth of Nations. This is from the final edition of The Theory of Moral Sentiments, Smith's other great work that he published, the final edition in 1790. So this was actually the last thing that he wrote. So here the point is that individuals are moral, are rational agents. They're not robots or chess pieces. So even the best, most enlightened political schemes might backfire if they're not well received by the people on whom the scheme is imposed. Movements away from even a non-ideal status quo could actually end up making things worse if the movements catalyze disrupting forces by breaking patterns of mutual expectations, perceptions of legitimacy, and so forth. I want to just mention something in passing. There is actually some reason to think that the man of system for Smith was none other than the physiocrat Turgot. And Turgot sought to impose liberal reforms in a fairly despotic way on the French people. One of Turgot's political allies and fellow reformers, Malesherbes, noted before his appointment with the guillotine that he and Turgot had been very well versed in science, but not very well versed in men. So I think there's reason to think that this is Turgot, but that's a different project. So let me turn now to theory and reality quickly. I don't want to go over my time. This is a deep matter, and Smith actually has much to offer us on this front. And the place to begin is with his posthumously published essay on the history of astronomy. It's not actually about the history of astronomy. It's about the psychological and sociological dimensions of philosophical inquiry. And one of the central points of that essay, I take it, is that we can hope for genuine improvements in science, but nonetheless, it's unreasonable to expect that the body of accepted scientific knowledge will ever completely close the gap between our explanations and the thing that we're trying to explain, which is reality itself. So moving quickly now past the astronomy essay, there are reasons to believe that Smith thought that the gap between theory and reality might in some respects be more acute and less likely to narrow in the accepted systems of moral science or moral philosophy. And part of the story here is that in moral philosophy, we are ultimately the objects of our inquiries, And so our interests and our self-perceptions are intimately intertwined with the outputs of moral science, including the outputs of economic theory. So in other words, how we theorize about economics, how we talk about economics, impacts the way we think about economics, and subsequently the kinds of policies that we propose. And this kind of logic is actually very close to Smith's criticism of the mercantile system, the mercantile system. Let me just, to close so I don't go over on time, say what I think is maybe the most significant point. It's at least the most straightforward point. These are more deeper, more philosophical matters. But Smith, in fact, uses multiple and in some cases incommensurable theories throughout The Wealth of Nations as he seeks to explain the causes of wealth. So the book is an inquiry into the nature and causes of the wealth of nations. What's Smith's answer to the question, what causes wealth? Well, he actually gives many different kinds of explanations, different sorts of theories that he proposes, and these theories are not often or not always commensurable. That is, he deploys different kinds of methodologies, historical, political, analytical, and so forth. So to make this point, I actually want to read something from a book written by a man who is not particularly Smithian, but nonetheless has some useful and accurate insights into the nature of Smith's thought. So this is Karl Polanyi, who wrote in 1944, the second great work of that year, along with The Road to Serfdom, the second great work in political economy, at least. And here's how Polanyi describes Smith. In Smith's view, one set of conditions which govern the wealth of nations, derived from the improving, stationary, or declining state of the country as a whole, another set derived from the paramountcy of safety and security, as well as the needs of the balance of power. Still another was given by the policy of the government as it favored town or countryside, industry or agriculture. Hence, it was only within a given political framework that he deemed it possible to formulate the question of wealth, by which he, for one, meant the material welfare of the great body of people. So in other words, what Polanyi is saying here is that if you read Smith closely, especially Book 4 of The Wealth of Nations, for which he's most justly famous, you find there different kinds of considerations of the causes of wealth, historical, analytical, political, and different kinds of considerations that manifest in his policy recommendations. So there's no easy way to map from the analytical theories of Book 1 of The Wealth of Nations that became considered by subsequent economists pure economic theory. There's no easy way to map from those theorems to some of his prescriptions in public policy across Book 4 and in Book 5 as well. So in other words, what you see when you read Smith, what you encounter when you read The Wealth of Nations, is a great mind seeking to bridge different modes of understanding, seeking to balance political stability, prudence, with his ultimate aim, which is to improve and liberalize society for the sake of the benefit of the ordinary citizens of the British Empire. So thank you.
All right, well, thank you all for being here. Thanks, Eric, for organizing this panel. So I'm going to give just some high-level remarks about, again, the significance of The Wealth of Nations and why it's worth reading. As Eric mentioned, it's long. It's probably not where, you know, a high school student should start, but it's worth reading at some point in its entirety to really understand the nuances, the scope that it has. So I've been reading some Nobel Prize winners who've written about Smith. Many Nobel Prize winners have written essays or articles about Smith, so I've been going back through those. I recently went through one exceptional one by Ronald Coase called Adam Smith's View of Man. And one of the things that Coase talks about, I think it's in that one, there's another one that he wrote, another essay he wrote, but I think he gives a reason why Smith is famous, why people consider him the father of economics. And what Coase says is that Adam Smith gave economics its shape. Okay, gave economics a shape. Now, this is in response for those of you who are not economists. You may or may not have heard of criticisms of The Wealth of Nations by Joseph Schumpeter and Murray Rothbard and others, but Schumpeter said something to the effect of everything that's right in The Wealth of Nations is not new, and whatever's new in The Wealth of Nations is not correct, right? Or that there's no single new analytic idea in The Wealth of Nations. And to some extent, Schumpeter is sort of correct that many of the things that Smith talks about are not new with him. People have talked about prices, they've talked about division of labor, they've talked about specialization. But what makes Smith and The Wealth of Nations famous is the way he organized and pulled all those things together, related them to one another. He deepened, I think, our understanding of some of these things. And so part of what I think might help us think through why Smith matters and his role in the history of economic thought is actually to use an analogy or metaphor in a different discipline, namely in chemistry. So you may or may not know much about the history of chemistry, but early to mid-1800s, scientists of various kinds had discovered a few different elements. They're trying to understand what these different elements are in terms of atoms and these fundamental building blocks. But there was not, they didn't know very many, and there wasn't any real way of organizing them. You have like this triad of like relating some elements to other elements. And then it was actually a Russian teacher of chemistry and science named Mendeleev who came up with the idea for the periodic table. And the periodic table, I think, is a great analogy for what The Wealth of Nations is. So what Mendeleev does is he creates this structure, right, this way of theorizing about different kinds of elements, the gases and the solids and the atomic number. And the analogy, I think, goes several steps. So he creates this analytical framework, but the analytical framework is largely empty, right? Today we know hundreds of elements, but at the time it was a dozen or two, right? So with relatively little information about elements, he theorizes this table, starts to organize it, has gaps where he literally has, you know, a couple elements and then there's just like insert element here. He's like, there should be elements here. If my theory is right, there should be elements that fit here or fit there. So there's gaps in his theory, and he recognizes that there's gaps, and he says, but there should be something here. And then what also is interesting is that as he formulates it, he finds that some of the atomic weights for some of the elements don't make sense based on where they fit on his table. And he's subsequently justified later. Later on, they discover, oh, yeah, actually, scientists got that atomic weight a little bit off. And so his analytical structure actually eventually overturns some of the empirical knowledge of the time. And Smith is doing this when it comes to trade or other kinds of things. And then the third piece, and Eric alluded to this, is that Mendeleev has this system that's really helpful, but he made his own mistakes. So, you know, there were some the atomic weights that he got wrong, or the where he put an element wasn't quite right. So it's not that Mendeleev just handed down the periodic table in its fullness, but rather he created this analytic structure that basically creates modern chemistry, right? Chemistry as a discipline is sort of built in many ways around the periodic table and the relating of the elements. And so Smith, I think, is doing something very similar with The Wealth of Nations, right? In terms of the language that economists use, the conversation that economists have, talking about land, labor, and capital, talking about wages, rent, wealth, talking about political economy, talking about the role of the state. So Smith is very important here in giving economics its shape. The terms that are used, the conversation that it begins, are all really kicked off in a big way by his book. So it's important in that regard for, as a historical matter, creating economics. I also think Smith as a thinker is important to wrestle with. So there's Wealth of Nations. Eric has mentioned Theory of Moral Sentiments. You'll probably hear that again. Another very important book. Smith actually kind of thinks of it as a superior book in some ways. And if you think about Theory of Moral Sentiments and Wealth of Nations together as a package, what you can begin to see is that Smith is a profound thinker. He's also a kind of visionary. So one of the arguments that I make to different audiences and when I write about Smith is one of the things I like about Smith's ethical structure in the Theory of Moral Sentiments is that he is the first philosopher, I think, to really see how commercial society is developing, how it's different from medieval society, different from agrarian societies, and the ways in which we need to rethink our ethics a little bit, and we need to rethink our virtues a little bit in a commercial society. The way that we relate to one another, the idea of trade and exchange, and what it means for, okay, how do people who have freedom and opportunity to change their professions. They're not tied to the land the way people have been historically. They're not tied to the trades that their parents and grandparents had. In this world of mobility and of freedom and of commerce and of wealth and of specialization, how do we think about ethics? How do we think about virtue? I think Smith is very kind of visionary in this regard and is really thinking through, in Theory of Moral Sentiments especially, what is the ethics of a commercial society? And how is it vary, or how is it different in some ways from a, say, medieval or more of an ancient society? And so he has this sort of vision of commercial society. He doesn't see it in its entirety, but he, I think he recognizes these sort of underlying changes that are going on and talks about that both in terms of market and ethics. Another element, and again, this is alluded to, is that Smith has an excellent political economy here, where he highlights and he criticizes in very clear terms costly behavior to society. And so he talks about how businessmen and women seek their own interests, so the East India Company, and about how he has this famous line about how people of the same occupation rarely get together, but their conversation doesn't begin to turn to colluding against the public, right? How do we raise our prices? How do we increase our profits? And so he's not naive as if, well, businessmen are angels and they're always looking out for the customer. He says, no, if people can find ways to limit competition or get special privileges like the British East India Company, or they get subsidies or bounties or various kinds of things, they're going to do it. So he is not naive here when it comes to businessmen, and he's not naive when it comes to government officials meddling in the economy. So that man of system claim, he talks about how government officials should not be trusted to tell people how to use their capital, to how to build their companies, what to invest in. And so he has this not fully anti-state, it's not a radical anti-state, but very, very critical of what government can do in the economy. And it's related to his theory of justice and his theory of ethics that he develops in Theory of Moral Sentiments as well. But again, I think the most profound elements of Smith and the things that have really, again, shaped economics that are still with us today is how he talks about the extended order and self-interest and coordination. And so some of you may be familiar with, he gives this example early on in the first book about the woolen coat. And he talks about how a woolen coat, just like a very basic coat that ordinary laborers would buy, nothing fancy, nothing special, but he says this is a profound product of the market that's involved hundreds and hundreds of people, from those raising the sheep to gathering the wool, to dyeing it, to spinning it, to putting it together. And that woolen coat is meant to illustrate the result of human action, but not of human design, as we think about spontaneous order today. And how we, and he says this very explicitly, that in a commercial society, we rely on the assistance of people we don't know all the time. And Coase makes the point that we can't know them. So Coase argues this, Hayek talks about this, I mentioned this on Thursday, about the two worlds that we live in, the kind of extended order and the local order. And I think you can read, it's not a perfect match, but you can read Theory of Moral Sentiments is thinking a lot about our local personal interactions with people, and Wealth of Nations being about the more extended, less personal kind of networks and transactions that we are a part of. Now, economists have really picked up on this, and there's a couple quotes I want to read here that I find very profound and helpful. One's by Milton Friedman, and one is by Ronald Coase here. So Milton Friedman talks about the strength of an economy that has impersonal exchange in it. Right? You know, a lot of people are trying to get, you know, personal. I want to know who made it, buy local, whatever. But Friedman says there's a lot of value to the idea of impersonal exchange because it depoliticizes things. So I think this is from Capitalism and Freedom. It might be from Free to Choose. I can't remember. But Friedman says the consumer who buys bread today does not know whether the wheat from which it was made was grown by a communist or a Republican, by a constitutionalist or a fascist, or for that matter, by a Negro or a white man. This illustrates how the market separates economic efficiency from irrelevant characteristics, right? And if you think about the highly charged political environment we're in today, and especially that we saw 2020, 2021, 2022, Part of it is like bringing all of this political elements into business that are not essential parts of the business, that all of a sudden we are trying to add to what is going on here. And then Coase talks about this as well, that the, one of the benefits of the market and commerce in a more or in a less personal way is that we don't rely on the weakness of sympathy. So as human beings, we have sympathy, and that's really helpful in very limited contexts where we know other people and feel beneficent for them. But that breaks very easily. You don't have to go very far before, you know, the person you've met once, okay, how much are you going to sacrifice to help them? And so Coase has one of my favorite quotes that I think really illustrates why markets are so important and why we should allow freedom and competition and people to participate. So Coase says that the great advantage of the market is that it is able to use the strength of self-interest to offset the weakness and partiality of benevolence, so that those who are unknown, unattractive, or unimportant will have their wants served, right? I think that is a profoundly humane way of viewing markets, right? That markets serve people, even if they're unpopular, even if they're not lovely, even if they're not well-known, right? You can go to the grocery store, you can go to the gas station, and you can get what you need. You can participate in society without having the right opinions, without having the right friends, without having the right connections. It's a very, in a good way, I think, a very democratic kind of thing that people can participate and do that. And it's there in Smith. Smith talks about this, you know, benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, the baker. He says even the beggar is not fully reliant on the beneficence of his fellow man. He's going to make trades and do other sorts of things. And so Smith recognizes that these markets are important for modern society. The division of labor makes us more productive, makes us wealthier, and allows us to interact in these kinds of ways. Now, I guess one more element I'll bring, and it's sort of the, you never win battles forever, they always are refought, the current tariff disputes and debates, right, that are going on. Smith was very involved in this back in his time. So he was emphasizing specialization, division of labor, extent of the market. And so for Smith, he sees international trade as an extension of local trade and international markets as an extension of the local markets. And so part of what makes people more productive is specializing, but specialization only makes sense if you can sell all of the extra stuff that you produce through specialization. So you need larger markets the more you specialize. And even a market as big as the U.S. is less large than the world market. And so the free trade is sort of an extension of this idea of specialization and productivity creating abundance. But Smith also goes deeper than that, and he focuses on the idea that it's an abundance and not money that matters, right? We have this focus on the trade deficit. What is the trade deficit? It's a measure of monetary value of goods that are being traded, not a measure of abundance, right, in sort of a fundamental sense. He also, and this is actually more Hume, but Smith is related to this, something called the price-specie flow mechanism, the idea that markets engage in self-correction and balance over time, that you have these forces. Again, Smith did not have a fully worked out monetary theory, but he had the core idea of competition, of prices, of these things that moderate and change over time. And so, again, just to wrap up here, the point is that Smith both helps us understand the discipline of economics and political economy. There's a historical element there, but then many of his core ideas are still very relevant today. What do we do about poor countries? We extend their markets. We don't give them foreign aid. Right? You want a country to become wealthy, I tell my students all the time, then you should be advocating getting rid of tariffs and quotas, right? Because that limits the extent of the market in poorer countries. Very fundamental stuff, division of labor, specialization, fundamental, but still relevant. Tariffs, it's another kind of issue. How is there corruption going on? He does, you know, Smith does talk about national security, so it's not that national security is irrelevant here, so that is part of the conversation, but he says we shouldn't get the economics of tariffs wrong. We shouldn't say that tariffs are going to make us rich, because that flies in the face of what we know about economics, about markets, about specialization, about trade. And it also flies in the face of the sort of open society, to use a later phrase, or commercial society that Smith was advocating. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Eric, for organizing this panel and including me, the non-economist. Yeah, let me just open with a few orienting comments. In an interdisciplinary conference like this, an interdisciplinary panel in a way, to help you understand where I'm coming at some of these questions from. So my background is in theology and intellectual history, so I'm not an economist, nor do I play one on TV, and I didn't even stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I won't be making any kind of economic claims, but I do want to take some time in these comments and in this presentation to talk about Smith and theology specifically. But to orient that discussion, I think we need to talk a little bit about the kind of turn to religion that we've seen broadly in intellectual history, especially as we think about the history of philosophy, the history of theology, more broadly intellectual history. As you can see, I'm populating the screen with a number of books that you can broadly say relate to religion and the Enlightenment, various figures, some of them broader texts. This is just a very occasional smattering. So, well, what are my comments going to be oriented around in terms of topics? Well, certainly within a question of religion and Enlightenment, and more narrowly, religion and the Scottish Enlightenment, and even more narrowly, Smith himself as a figure within the broader Scottish Enlightenment, and even more narrowly even than Smith and religion, more a question of what is Smith's relationship to theology. Here another set of books that relate to some of these more narrower questions than the ones on the previous slide having to do with Smith and religion. So if we're talking about Smith and Christian religion, or the relationship between Smith and theology, there are a number of what I think are interesting questions, avenues worth exploring, questions like, how was Smith shaped by his religious and theological context? What were those contexts, right? So you could talk about the broadly religious context, you could talk about the more narrowly Christian context, and even more narrowly the Scottish Presbyterian context, for example. Many people have been interested in what Smith's own religious and theological beliefs were, right? That's a very intriguing and interesting set of questions. To the extent that we can understand these beliefs, how did they inform Smith's published work and the work that we've received of the various genres and provenances, and vice versa? What can we infer of his own personal beliefs from his published works and the works that we have of his? What were the theological sources for Smith's published works, right? That's an interesting intellectual exercise, I think, and worthwhile, trying to understand what sources he used, deployed, would have been exposed to, and thought of as interesting in his own work. And then a more kind of normative or practical question, what's the upshot? So what? Smith thought some things about religion and theology. Why should anybody care? What is the significance of Smith's work from a theological and even moral perspective? Those are all worthwhile questions. We will not be examining all of those. Certainly we'll take a stab at a couple of them maybe in the brief time that we've got together, the next 10 to 12 minutes or so. And the two questions I want to kind of focus on are more narrowly a question about Smith's relationship to Scripture, and you'll see in a minute why I want to focus on that, and then to the extent that we have time, I'll take a stab at the fourth question there: what were the theological sources for Smith's published work, or at least an angle on starting to answer some of those questions. So no ultimate or settled answers in this presentation today, I don't think, in any broad sense, but we'll try to come to some conclusions that might be helpful as I point towards possibilities for future work and things that are continuing to be interesting. So with Smith and Scripture, it's a big question, of course. You could do methodologically lots of interesting things, see where Smith cited Scripture, where there were allusions and those sorts of things, and that work has been done. I've done some work more narrowly focusing on a particular claim that pops up in the scholarship, and not just the scholarship, but kind of popular accounts of Smith, especially as related to this most famous work of his, The Wealth of Nations. So this is actually one that was new to me. I was talking to Eric about this earlier this week. Harvey Cox, who some of you may know, a theologian who's written a lot on theology, free societies, and especially economics in this book, The Market is God. I've got it highlighted there. I don't know if you can read it. He says, notice from the epigraph to this chapter, right, and that's a quote from Isaiah 60, verse 5. Notice from this epigraph to this chapter, for example, that Smith borrows the title of his most famous book, The Wealth of Nations, from the Bible. So that's a claim, right? That is what I would call a strong form of that claim. Smith is borrowing the title of his book from the Bible. that seems like it would have some theological significance if it were true, right? There are a number of people who make this kind of claim. I'm just using Cox as an example. This was published, I think, in 2016. So somewhat recently, within the last 10 years, there's a line of people. You'll see this pop up over and over, this kind of claim. I don't see a footnote there. This book does have some footnotes in it, but not on this claim. And after times, you know, over and over again running into this kind of a claim, it started to bother me a little bit. Or at least it raised the question, does Smith do this? And I also encountered what you might call weaker forms of the claim. That would be like, instead of making this assertion, it would be sort of like, you know, Smith might have been making this allusion by choosing this title. Okay, so let's evaluate that claim, because it would be significant if Smith thought of himself in these prophetic terms. And in fact, that's exactly what Cox does. Cox says, actually, we should understand Adam Smith as a theologian, and partly because of this claim, right? Because that's how Smith understood himself, by invoking the Bible. He sets himself up as an economic prophet, in a way, a theological prophet on economic life. Now, Cox has his own readings of, you know, the Smithian line up through Hayek and Friedman and others. And he actually, you know, thinks Smith is better. He's prophetic in a good way, as opposed to some of his supposed inheritors. But we're not going to get into the rest of Cox's claims here and his elaboration. I just wanted to illustrate this as an example of this quite strong claim that you encounter in the literature. Well, what Bibles and scriptures would Smith have been interacting with? I'll say a little bit about this slide. For example, these two points I've got here are the scriptures that were known to be in Smith's library. So this is taken from Smith's catalog. There are a number. If we have time, I'll get into some of what Smith actually owned. And of course, you have to make, you know, considerations there with respect to Smith read more things than he owned. And just because he owned it doesn't mean he necessarily read it. But it still seems relevant, the kinds of things he would have had in the bookshelves surrounding his home and his study and that kind of thing. So he owned a 1722 Edinburgh edition of the King James Version and a Greek New Testament. That's what we know. Well, what happens if you look at that verse, and Cox was relying on Isaiah 60, verse 5. If you look at it in the King James Bible. This is just a slide real quick of one of those places where people have noted where Smith engages with Scripture, right? So that's that bottom left-hand slide. So those are a couple of the kind of explicit allusions to Scripture that occur in The Wealth of Nations, for example. The right-hand side picture is that page from the 1722 Edinburgh edition of the King James Bible of Isaiah chapter 60. And if you pull it out, you can look at it in English, and maybe you can even read it, although the print, the scan isn't great. It reads, the relevant line is there at the bottom, the forces of the Gentiles. Okay, that's Isaiah 65 in the King James Version. There is a footnote there that says you could translate forces as wealth. So then the phrase would be wealth of the Gentiles. Not exactly the wealth of nations, right? Okay, were there any English Bibles extant at Smith's time that used that phrase? That seems like that'd be a relevant question. Let's see. Well, I did my best to find it. I'm not saying I looked at everything, but I looked at certainly everything that was published that I could find in English Bible history up through 1776 or through the 18th century. And here's what I found. Here's how that phrase is rendered. It's Chayil Goyim in the Hebrew. It's plautos ethnon in the Greek, okay? So that's what those two words are referring to, and that's how do you render those in English? An interesting translational question. Well, Wycliffe in the 14th century, the wealth of the heathen, we see. The strength of the Gentiles seems to be a popular one in the 16th century. We find that in Coverdale, in Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible, Tavener's Bible, in the Roman Catholic Douay-Rheim Bible, in the different editions, the riches of the Gentiles, the forces of the Gentiles, as we've seen in King James, the host of the Gentiles, the forces of the nations. I can't find the wealth of nations in Scripture, in English Scripture, in Smith's time, at least in anything that was published that it would have made any sense to anybody, right? So for this strong claim to be true, it had to be a phrase that was in currency, in being used in the language and be not just used in the language, but being referred to with respect to scripture, right? So here's an engram of Wealth of Nations. It's very similar if you add the at the beginning and search for the Wealth of Nations. It's certainly a term that is used, and I also do a survey of the sacred and secular literature, so religious literature that's not scripture and secular literature. And it does seem like, as many others have noted, that the Wealth of Nations is becoming, by Smith's time, a term of art to be used in political economy, right? And after Smith, you do see a continued use and appearance of this phrase in English texts. So that's one more bit of evidence trying to help us understand what the Wealth of Nations might have meant. When did it start to appear in Bibles? Well, here's what I found. Pretty much in the 19th century, it starts to be used to translate those sections from Isaiah and other places. So here's a list of most of the major English Bibles from the late 19th into the 20th and even the 21st century, where now you're seeing Wealth of Nations all the time in English translations of the Bible. So what's going on here? Well, it seems pretty clear to me and definitive that Smith is not making an explicit allusion to Isaiah 60 verse 5 or any of the other prophetic texts that refer to the forces of the Gentiles or the wealth of the nations. And in fact, maybe the causality goes the other way, right? Smith's fame, to the extent that he has it, in the Wealth of Nations becomes a popular phrase in English, a term of art certainly for political economy, and by the 19th century seems like a natural choice to translate this, and you see that being chosen. So here's an example of dispelling, I think, a myth of the supposed relationship or significance of Smith and scripture and the relationship between him and religious and theological traditions. I've just got a minute or two left, so I'll say a little bit more about Smith's sources. There are three main kind of bibliographical pieces. Bonner wrote one and put together a catalog in the 19th century that was not exhaustive. Mizuta updated that and added a number of sources, and then Dan Klein and Humphreys in 2019 published an appendix in addition to that. So this is where I got the information, for example, of what Smith's scripture, what versions of the Bible were in Smith's library, for example. So Bonner, again, this is the earliest one. Here's how he categorizes the rough spread of texts that Smith possessed. You can see literature and art, classical authors, law, politics, geography, political economy, history, science, philosophy, and a very slim sliver there, miscellaneous. What's missing? Well, anything theology or religion. I'll skip to the upshot. Based on Mizuta, there's questions about what counts as a theological source. We can talk about that too. Mizuta has 1,800 titles, and depending on how you slice it, answering what counts as a theological source, I identified 250 plus or more of those, roughly that much, that at least has a significant theological significance, so it treats a theological topic, or it's by someone that has at least some ostensible religious connection. So many of these people are writing in many different fields. Maybe it's an ordained person, but they're not writing on theology. That could count as a theological source potentially for Smith. So that's where we're at. The rest of these slides are kind of brief looks at some of the more interesting sources that appear in Smith's library. He doesn't have much old stuff in the sense of ancient sources. It really picks up. There's a few things that you could categorize as the Middle Ages. Probably the earliest thing is the Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy. Not that he has an early edition of it, but these are the kind of the earliest sources that he owns himself. So implications for future research. I mean, I think if we want to inhabit Smith's world and part of his mental world, we need to be familiar with the sources that he would have been using, the kinds of scriptures that he would have been engaging with, which helps us to answer these kinds of questions about whether Smith was intending to refer to the Hebrew prophets by naming his greatest work, The Wealth of Nations, and so on. And lots more work to do. If you want more, this last slide is a bit of the bibliography for some of the claims that I've made or the counterclaims that I've made in these brief comments, as well as a plug. I felt like I knew Eric wouldn't do it, but we've got a new 2-volume project coming out in a few weeks on the history and sources of Christian political economy. The CRCD table out there has a flyer too with a code you can scan to go to the publisher website and even get 40% off if you're interested in that. But yeah, thank you.
I can do an extremely short version of this paper. But first, let me say thank you as well to Eric for putting this panel together. This is really great fun. It's about 15 years ago that we would have been taking some classes together, and I think maybe 20 years ago that I first came across Jordan when I was an undergraduate going to some Acton stuff, and I think you were there by then. So this is just great fun for me, and I hope we're still doing this decades from now. So I'm here to talk about Smith and his potential influence and certainly relation to Catholic social teaching. The short version of my paper is something along these lines. If we want to look at the relationship between Catholic social teaching and Smithian economics, specifically with respect to the way they treat property, I believe that it is fair to say that we see some good Smithian influence in Rerum Novarum. It's hard to pin down precisely, but I think that there's good reason to believe that they're drawing on similar traditions, and there's less evidence, but still some evidence that there's direct influence between Smith's insights and Rerum Novarum, the text. There are arguments that, going back at least to the 80s, probably quite a bit further, 1980s, 1960s even, that Rerum Novarum is unduly influenced by Lockeanism, by a Lockean justification for private property, which is unworkable, ultimately. And therefore, we should expect to see that tension causing problems. And in fact, we perhaps do, that by the time we get to Gaudium et Spes, and much, much more recently, De Laxite, that the tensions have caused real issues, and we now see a Catholic theory of property that goes back to some earlier roots, perhaps in Aquinas, and is much more critical of the market. My arguments today are first that the property theory in Rerum Novarum is better read as akin to Smith's theory of property rather than Locke's, that the move in Gaudium et Spes and De Laxite is rather a mistake in that it is a movement simultaneously away from a more thorough or more robust defense of private property and a move away from its Thomistic roots, and that while things look a little grim today for those of us like myself who believe that private property was correctly treated in Rerum Novarum, that we don't yet need to despair entirely. So that's the really short version of the paper, and I can expand on different elements of that paper as is necessary. But so since I have a little bit more time, I'll give some more detail on each of those points. But depending on the audience, I've now given this paper to, well, this is the second time I'm giving it, excuse me, with an audience of some economists, some theologians. I'm sort of trying to do history of thought here as really an economist. I don't know which parts to expand on. I'm happy to share the whole paper and eventually hope to get it published. But for now, let me begin with the first idea. That is that Rerum Novarum talks about property in some pretty significant ways. Many of you will have read Rerum Novarum. The first third of the document really is about property. It's supposed to be about the labor question, but Pope Leo nails down property first and says that the labor question cannot be solved save by assuming as a principle that private ownership must be held sacred and inviolable. So that's a pretty strong claim. I like that claim. That's a good one. And his defense at face value does sound Lockean. He says in this key passage, when man thus turns the activity of his mind and the strength of his body toward procuring the fruits of nature, by such act he makes his own that portion of nature's field which he cultivates. That sounds like Locke's, he mixes his labor with it and thereby makes it his property. And so this is Waterman in 1991 puts it really nicely calls it a conflation of two radically incompatible elements, a traditional Thomistic theory derived from human rationality and a pseudo-Lockean version derived from a labor theory of appropriation. So a portion of my paper, I trace through this argument and attempt to rebut some of that claim and say instead a better reading is to look at the way the impartial spectator plays an important role for Smith in how we make claims about property, and that property is both an individual, based on an individual action, and it's a social, has a social dimension. And that's an important part of more traditional treatments of property, including going back to Aquinas and before. And so I argue that Smith's theory of property, though he introduces this notion of the impartial spectator that is somewhat unique, it is at root more akin to the Thomistic argument that human rationality and human interaction is really the foundation of property. It's not the labor itself, it's the expectations we form by exerting our labor with respect to an external observer. So it is fundamentally social. And that argument is not my own. That comes from Hawkinson. And so I think I'm on firm ground there with respect to a proper understanding of Smith, that he's not just Locke with slightly different language. It is a different way of doing, of grounding property. And so I compare that language to some of the language in Rerum Novarum, and I say, I think actually we should look a little more carefully that Rerum Novarum looks a little like Locke, but it looks much more like this Smithian social form of property. And it is definitely true that some of the drafters of Rerum Novarum were familiar with Smith's work. So I think it's not too much of a leap to say there would have been some direct influence there, and at least you can say they're participating in the same tradition. So property rights are simultaneously social and grounded in individual action. That's important. I also then go back to Aquinas and make a claim that Aquinas is not so opposed to some of the implications of a Lockean version of property as Waterman and others would claim, that yes, for Aquinas, the universal destination of goods is extremely important, but following here, Mary Hirschfeld in her 2018 book, Aquinas in the Market, making a critical observation that when Aquinas talks about property, at least one of the three reasons is not related to human sin. That Aquinas's second justification for private property is that it is, even if all human beings had perfect goodwill, you still need to assign particular people to particular tasks. You can't walk out the door each morning and just decide from among the infinite array of things that need doing which one should be done by you, that collective work needs to be done by matching finite persons with finite or finite pieces of the collective work. And so there, it is not as though the tradition in the church is just that private property is a concession to sin. It's more than that. It's deeper than that. And so we don't need to be quite so concerned that the implications of the Lockean-ish and, in my argument, more Smithian view of property is at odds with Aquinas. There's an opening there for the two to meet. So I continue in the paper to discuss some of the bad news, which is an observation that others have made, that the defense of private property in more recent Catholic social teaching has weakened somewhat. That there's in particular a footnote in Gaudium et Spes that is quoted in De Lexi Te, or a passage from Gaudium et Spes that is referred to in De Lexi Te, and a crucial footnote is dropped. Michael Pakulik was the one to make this observation first, and so I've detailed some of that in this paper. It's an important piece of the argument. But that essentially the current treatment by Pope Francis that has been picked up by the new Pope Leo is, I'm not sure if I want to say sloppy, but it drops an important qualification, a very important qualification that goes back to Aquinas. And that is that the universal destination of goods is the way that that works is by assuming a default of private property, and then with certain important exceptions, there can be taking by the needy from others. There's a passage about entitled to take that is originally more like they can take what they need from the riches of others. Well, I can get into that if I need to. There's some room for hope. This is where it's an important piece of the argument. That is, because Pope Leo in De Lexite was working largely from a draft that Francis had written, I think it's, out of charity, we should assume that maybe it doesn't represent the fullness of his thought. There are some signs for hope, like in an address to the Argentine Industrial Conference in November, a month after De Lexite, Pope Leo sent a message to this conference affirming that workers who receive just wages, quote, can also aspire to ownership. And he says that economic efficiency and fidelity to the gospel are not opposed, describes the economy as something that can and must be an engine of inclusion and justice. And I think that sounds a little more like the paragraph 46 in Rerum Novarum, to bring us back to the real good stuff. The law should favor ownership, and its policy should be to induce as many people to become owners. So that's the tradition in which productive work, just wages, and the aspiration to ownership are engines of human dignity. There are also critiques in De Lexite of the, quote, invisible market forces that in paragraph 92, Pope Leo criticizes pseudoscientific data invoked to support the claim that free markets will, quote, automatically solve the problem of poverty. I think that Pope Leo is attacking what ought to be just a straw man, I think isn't always. I think there are people who treat the market that way, as though it's magical. But I think there's some mistaken views on both sides, perhaps. There are those advocates of the free market who do treat it the way that he's accusing us of, but then there are many others who don't. And so I would like to see some better conversation between the two. So where does it leave us? I end the paper by saying that the resources for recovery are there in Aquinas, in Leo XIII, in Smith, and perhaps even on his best day somewhere in Leo XIV's writings. And so the task for myself and others interested in this conversation is to articulate a vision of property in which the universal destination of goods is served by, rather than opposed to, the institution of private property. And importantly, where the limits of state knowledge are taken as seriously as the demands of justice. So I can expand on any part of that, but that's the basic paper. So thank you very much.
You have been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us, our programs, and to sign up for our newsletter, please visit ciceroniansociety.org.